Revolt Radio.
Security Council. It was done with full coordination of the members of the national security team. The president has been involved every step of the way. He and I discussed it at Crawford at the beginning of August. We had discussed it at the end of July. And so there is absolutely no substance to this mischievous fictional story about Colin Powell and the Joint Chiefs of Staff colluding in some way. We didn't do it, and it wasn't necessary. We didn't need to put this pressure on the president. The president had authorized me from the very beginning to move in this direction. Yes.
Thank you. To which extent you will allow the United Nations to take part into the political process in Iraq? And for Minister Frattini, I'd like to ask, there was a meeting between Vladimir Putin and Prime Minister Berlusconi. Did Mr. Putin say to Mr. Berlusconi that he agrees to go ahead with this kind of resolution? Were they informed about this?
As you will see from the resolution, there are a number of operative paragraphs where the UN is invited and asked and directed to do more to help the Iraqi Governing Council put in place an electoral system so that they can hold elections, to make available all of the organizations of the UN that have expertise in creating institutions of democracy, to participate with the Coalition Provisional Authority and the Iraqi Governing Council in coming forward.
I'm not going to even let you go on this, all this tap dance and jigaboo and man-tanning nonsense, Colin. You're right. Boy George didn't authorize you to say some of the things that you said before, but now he's given you authorization. In other words, Massa has now told you to come out and help spin his macho charades that has made him look like a weak-kneed John Wayne cowboy, and just like a good man-tanning Negro, here you come, trying to defend the undefendable. But then again, you're a Republican. You're a militarist. You believe in Sam. You believe in Massa. You believe in this free market imperial system. But you best believe in something else. You're going to be one of the first Negroes hanging from a tree. Slave revolt style. Check this out. Listening to 104.1, 93.7, San Francisco, 96.3, Santa Cruz, 106.5, Illinois, LUBER.com, the world, Slave Revolt Radio Time. First, we got Gerald kicking it off with the Making It Plain News update, as he's going to be talking about war, war, and the horrors of imperialist war. Then, we're going to blast our way into here they go again, the lesser of two evils. We must go percentage, or carry, or never mind, the devil or Satan. You know what's up. We got all that and a whole lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt Radio.
let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace, proud of our ancient heritage, and unwilling to witness or permit the slow undoing of those human rights to which this nation has always been committed and to which we are committed today at home and around the world.
This is a friendly crowd in downtown Dallas, and the first red lights are now visible coming far down the street, just having now turned right-hand onto Main off of Harwood.
I was on Simmons Freeway earlier, and even the freeway was jam-packed with spectators waiting their chance to see the president as he made his way towards the trade park. President's car is now turning on to Elm Street, and it will be only a matter of minutes before he arrives at the trademark. It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Simmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by. Just a moment, please. There has been a shooting. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound.
And the first unconfirmed reports say the president was hit in the head. That's an unconfirmed report that the president was hit in the head.
President Kennedy has been assassinated. It's official now. The president is dead. The president of the United States is dead.
Malcolm X, you were involved in a controversy some months ago with your leader. Is that over?
Well, I've been silent for the past 90 days because of some statements I made concerning the President of the United States, which were distorted.
They were distorted?
And yes.
What did you say, Malcolm?
Well, I said the same thing that everybody says, that his assassination was the result of the climate of hate.
But
I said the chickens came home to roost, and which means the same thing. Climate of hate means that this is the result of something. And when I said chickens coming home the roof, I said the same thing.
But you did not say that you were glad the president was killed.
No, that's what the press said.
Uh-huh.
What would I look like saying that I'm glad the president was killed?
Lee Harvey Oswald killed no one at all. So the point is, it wasn't a question of being alone or with anybody. He had nothing to do with the assassination.
On January 31st, 1992, NBC conducted a telephone survey asking American citizens who they thought killed President John F. Kennedy. NBC received 30,000 calls in 3 hours. 51% said the CIA did it.
Brothers and sisters, and friends, and I see some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. I'm Gerald Smith, and this is your Making It Plain News Service. Okay, on this day in 1918, Russia, American troops land in Archangel in North Russia, 1 year after the Russian Revolution, to supposedly protect U.S. interests. They are ultimately soundly defeated in a little-known U.S. invasion with disastrous effects of U.S. policy, foreign policy, in the following decades. 1978, this day, simultaneous demonstrations against nuclear weapons and power in Red Square, Moscow, and the White House lawn, Washington, D.C. And last, in 1982, on this day, in Germany, 10,000 people dance on nuclear reactor site, Gelobe, in West Germany. As many of our consistent listeners may understand, we here at Slave Revolt try to show our listeners how phrases like free speech, the free market, and the free world have little, if anything, to do with freedom. We try to show, among the myriad freedoms claimed by the U.S. government, are the freedom to murder, annihilate, and dominate other people. The freedom to finance and sponsor despots and dictators across the world. The freedom to train, arm, and shelter terrorists. The freedom to topple democratically elected governments. The freedom to amass and use weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, and nuclear. The freedom to go to war against any country whose government it disagrees with. And most terrible of all, the freedom to commit these crimes against humanity in the name of justice, in the name of righteousness, and in the name of freedom. Well, we'll see how long this scam goes on, because old boy George is running out of fools, as Aretha would say. So, right now, just show you something very simple. Bush is right now using 10,000 mercenary private army, a 10,000 mercenary private army in Iraq, and they crying about money. Get this, y'all. I got this information from the Christian Science Monitor. It says that nearly 10,000 private military contractors are currently working in Iraq, training a new Iraqi military, protecting the Baghdad and the Basra airports, and feeding and housing U.S. troops. Several hundred contractors remain on the ground in Afghanistan as well, providing such services as security for President Hamid Karzai. The exponential growth in contractors during the 1990s, there have been nearly 10 times as many contractors used in 2003, in the 2003 Iraqi invasion, as in the 1991 Persian Gulf invasion, is the result of several factors. Now get this. It's the downsizing of the military. The fact that U.S. troops are stretched thin because of their several global commitments, and a lack of planning by the Pentagon. It's something that else I want to add that the Christian Monitor did not see, and that is the truth of the matter is that there is a lack of commitment on the part of the American people to follow the Pentagon into these crazed adventures. You see, when you paying 10,000 people, you wondering, Why are they in a financial crisis? Well, the 10,000 contractors that they're paying, they have to pay a lot more than what they pay in soldiers. They don't want to make the army too big because, well, to tell you the truth, in the 70s, in the early 80s, the army had stretched to 1 million. And half of them was brothers. And they knew, deep in the bottom of their capitalist souls, they knew that that army wasn't absolutely reliable because they had just gone through the Vietnam situation where on the ground, and this is, people don't talk about it a lot, the army had turned on their officers many times. Many officers came back in a pine box because the ranks simply refused to follow them. Nearly 1.4 million, just to sum that up, they have to pay people because, and the New York Times made this evident, right after 9-1-1, they checked the figures to see, given all this hand-wringing and we got to get the Arabs and all this old talk, filthy racist bullshit they was pushing, the number of people joining the army did not increase, according to the New York Times. Now, you would think, since, you know, it's so great here, and Americans love all that patriotism, all that old malarkey, that the number of people would have increased. It did not. And in fact, now I bet you anything the number's going down. See, these are contradictions they cannot answer. They have no answer. They cannot and they will not. And that's why we know in the end we will win. Now, nearly 1.4 million more people just sunk into poverty. The nation's rocky economy sent 1.4 million more people into poverty last year, a Census Bureau survey found. Nearly half of the newly impoverished were children. Roughly 17.2% of children, or 12.2 million, lived in poverty in 2002, up from 16.4%, or over 11.5 million, in 2001, according to the American Community Survey results released this past Wednesday. Overall, 12.4% of the population, or nearly 34.8 million people, lived in poverty in 2002, up from 12.1%, or 33.4 million the previous year. So just understand this, and I'm not gloating, I'm not happy that more people are suffering, but more people are suffering. The system is crumbling. Open your eyes, look at it, and let's start thinking about what we're going to do about it. Now I want to give a closer look at these anti-war Democrats, because they done had them going around the country and they making these speeches, and I'm afraid that people are getting confused. The main contenders for the nomination of the Democratic Party for U.S. President are former Governor Howard Dean, Senator John Edwards, Representative Dick Gephardt, Senator Bob Graham, Senator John Kerry, Representative Dennis Kucinich, excuse me, thank you, Reg. Senator Joseph Liebman, former Senator Carol Mosley Braun, and Reverend Al Sharpton. Okay? Also running against Bush and the Democratic nominee will be a candidate for the Peace and Freedom Party, as well as candidates from other socialist parties and a potential candidate from the Green Party. Four of the contenders for the Democratic nomination, Dick Gephardt, John Kerry, Joe Liebman, and John Edwards, were amongst the mainly Democrats in the House and Senate who voted for the U.S. war against Iraq. Dennis Kucinich, Howard Dean, Carol Mosley Braun, and Al Sharpton are painting their candidacies as anti-war. Let's start off with Governor Howard Dean. Howard Dean has challenged the Bush administration's lies regarding Iraq's supposed nuclear weapons programs and has called for an investigation. Okay. Yet Dean has also stated, and I quote, "I believe then and I believe now that removing Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq was a just cause. But not every just cause requires that we go to war, especially with inadequate planning and without maximum support." So, what does this really mean, y'all? That means that he's looking at it as a tactical difference with his Republican adversary. You understand? So Dean has no problem with invading a sovereign nation for the benefit of the U.S. and getting that oil, killing around 7,000 Iraqi civilians and making U.S. soldiers into a hated occupation army. That was a just cause, so he says. Dean's issue is with Bush's lack of planning. By inference, Dean claims that as president, he would plan imperialist wars better than Bush. No, thank you. In addition, Dean has stated, and I quote, "General Shinseski's professional military advice that 2,000 troops would be needed was rejected. I would add at least 50,000 foreign troops to the force in Iraq." Well, we just talked about that. Where's he going to get the troops from? In the lean, mean U.S. killing machine. They'd have to reenact the draft. Y'all watch this, some bitch. Y'all watching. That's the only way you're going to get most people ain't running and joining the army. So where are you going to get all these troops from? While the Iraqi people are fighting to liberate themselves from a foreign occupation army that has set up a completely subservient puppet government and caused the collapse of the Iraqi economy, Dean is calling for more troops from other nations to maintain the imperial order. And that looks like what they're trying to do right now. So some of the more far-sighted bourgeois elements are not opposed to Bush in principle. They just see he's a fool and they try to make it work. Dean states, and I quote, "What I want to know is why in the world the Democratic Party's leadership is supporting the president's unilateral attack on Iraq." That from the Milwaukee Journal. Dean would have supported the war if it was done with U.S. backing. At the heart of Dean's opposition is the idea that U.S. imperialist interests would be better served if the U.N. were backing the war. This view does not respect the right of the Iraqi people to self-determination. It should also be remembered that such so-called unilateral action was also taken with the U.S. war against Yugoslavia under Clinton. Representative Dennis Kucinich, I must say, at the recent event that we had last Friday, Saturday, Black August, and, we celebrated the Haitian Revolution. Oh, we had about 700 people present, but one of the tables there was Kucinich's people, you know? And this is about as far left as the Democratic Party can get. And they pushing him like he's some kind of socialist or something. I had to say, excuse me, but this is the Democratic Party we're talking about. Very good people. We had some interesting discussions. But the fact of the matter is, and let's look at old Dennis, okay? Dennis is also portraying himself as an anti-war candidate in the Democratic Party. Yet on his website, the Kucinich campaign states that Kucinich, quote, supports a strong and efficient military. He believes that the current practice of procuring ever more costly weapons has the effect of weakening military readiness. As the cost of new weapons systems rise, the cost of merely replacing aging weapons with new ones becomes prohibitively expensive. As a result, U.S. military forces shrink, while they become at the same time more expensive to maintain and more prone to failure. This is the same position that's taken, that's closed quote now, this is the same position that's taken recently by two U.S. generals waging war in Iraq. During the U.S. invasion, the ongoing Iraq war, General Stanley McChrystal complained, and I quote, "It was enough for the enemy to show a little resistance and some creative thinking as our technological superiority begun to quickly lose all its meaning. Our expenses are not justified by the obtained results. The enemy is using an order of magnitude cheaper weapons to reach the same goals for which we spend billions on technological whims of the defense industry," unquote. So even the generals realize this. That ain't the question. The question is, was that just to bomb those people? That's the question. Similarly, General Richard Mayers commented on precision-guided munitions, and I quote, "The rate of their use is incompatible with the obtained results. We are literally dropping gold into the mud." Now, that's a legitimate argument within the bourgeoisie about how to best use their monies. Once again, was it right or was it wrong? Dennis Kucinich's position on military funding is not one that calls for an end to U.S. imperialist wars, but instead calls for a more cost-effective and deadly military to terrorize and keep in line the semi-colonial people of the world. The contradiction here is limited to the difference between the pure profiteering of the military-industrial complex and the desire for actual cost-effective results for imperialist victory on the battlefield. Dennis Kucinich spoke to a gathering at the Southern Californian California Americans for Democratic Action. And at that gathering, he claimed, we, that is he and the Congress, did not authorize an eye for an eye. Nor did we ask that the blood of innocent people who perished on September 11th be avenged with the blood of innocent villagers in Afghanistan. We did not authorize the administration to wage war anytime, anywhere, anyhow it pleases. We did not authorize war without end. We did not authorize a permanent war economy. Yet we are upon the threshold of a permanent war economy. Unquote. Yet that is exactly what Dennis Kucinich, and the rest of the Congress, with the exception of California Democrat Barbara Lee, agreed to with their votes authorizing Bush's endless war on the world. The entire Democratic Party in both the Senate and Congress, with only one exception, voted for war. Sure they did. Since votes have since been taken authorizing the U.S. war in Iraq, the most practical application of this vote by Kucinich was to authorize the U.S. war on Afghanistan. In stark contrast to Kucinich's vote for war, this author, well, we mentioned back about 2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as the World Trade Center collapsed, yet it was a horror no different from what the U.S. government has done with its bombing of civilian populations in Iraq, Yugoslavia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Panama, and Korea. The U.S. bombing of these countries killed millions of civilians. Terror against civilians is never justified. Now the U.S. government is preparing to terror bomb Afghanistan. That's what they used it. The U.S. war in Afghanistan has, in fact, killed well over 3,000 civilians and brought the Afghanistan nation to back to the chaos of fragmented warlord rule, last seen after the various U.S.-trained and financed Mujahideen forces defeated the Soviet-backed PDPA government. Now, those same Mujahideen forces have defeated the Taliban once again with U.S. backing, and they are just as incapable of bringing a decent life or even political stability to Afghanistan. It's a mess in Afghanistan right now. The same, you know, over and over again, we see this, you know, people want to embrace, you know, these candidates, thinking, well, you know, and I tell you, percentage is, you know, that's the left wing of the Democratic Party, so-called. But you can't, just by wishful thinking, turn manure into gold, you know. Stay away from that. So Dennis Kucinich, the so-called peace candidate, as much as he may now want to deny it, voted for the war on Afghanistan and played his part in making it happen. Some may argue that Kucinich is not perfect, but he make a better president than Bush. Yet it is unlikely that Kucinich has any intention of winning the presidency. His role is one of bringing the anti-war movement and others who are breaking from the establishment and the twin parties of capitalism back into the fold of the pro-war Democratic Party. Kucinich makes this point clear when he states, and I quote, "The Democratic Party created third parties by running to the middle. What I'm trying to do is go back to the big tent so that everyone who felt alienated could come back through my candidacy." Now that sounds like a strategy to me. That don't sound like somebody worried about winning an election, you know? Yet that tent that Kucinich speaks of is one that, despite its name, is not democratic. It is a tent dominated by big capital and the politicians subservient to it. It is under this tent that the ruling class would like to swallow up the legitimate opposition of the people towards war and turn us into the water boys for so-called responsible politicians. I'll give an example about how undemocratic. When Jesse Jackson was running in 1988, there were a lot of people who wanted the United States to stop funding Jonas Savimbi's UNITA because they were wreaking havoc in Angola. So people brought their little signs, stop funding UNITA, to the Democratic Party convention. And they went in the thing and they thought, this is a Democratic Party, let me express my view. The Democratic Party leadership had the police arrest elected delegates to the Democratic Party convention for carrying those signs inside the convention. What kind of politics is that? On the third parties who are trying to build a real alternative to the pro-war Democratic Party, Mr. Kucinich states, I have no interest in a third-party candidacy. None. I want to do it the other way. Bring the third-party candidates into the Democratic Party. Here again, very clear. Now let's talk about Reverend Al Sharpton. Come on. Because clearly, he's even to the left of Kucinich. This is another candidate who was opposed to war in Iraq and is much less likely to give his endorsement to other openly pro-war and racist Democrats. That's Al Sharpton. Speaking on this issue, the New Republic opined, quote, anyone who rules out the possibility that in August 2004, an aggrandized Sharpton will, after a private conversation with Karl Rove, issue a pain statement declaring that the Democratic nominee has betrayed the party's base and doesn't deserve the Reverend's endorsement, should have a conversation with Robert Abrams, Mario Cuomo, and Mark Green. In other words, he hasn't done it, you know, in New York, where he's from. Yet Sharpton's lack of loyalty to the racist and pro-war Democratic Party machine has not meant endorsements for the authentic parties of the left that uphold much of the program that Sharpton claims to represent. Instead, Sharpton has stooped as low as endorsing Republican boss Al D'Amato to show his dissatisfaction with the Democratic Party. This has accomplished nothing but the bolstering of the twin parties of war and racism that rule America. Sharpton's support for both Democrat and Republicans, while pretending to be leading a crusade against war and racism, makes particular sense in light of the fact that he is a self-admitted informant for the FBI. The FBI, as America's internal political police, play a role in carrying out spying, infiltration, disruption, harassment, disorientation, and even murder against anti-racists, anti-war, and other organizers in this country. When asked about the new provisions of the Patriot Act that allow for all kinds of FBI surveillance, Sharpton himself responded, and I got to quote this, what you're really doing is allowing the government to do overtly now what they did covertly in the 60s. Not only did Dr. King, but to every group, from the Black Panthers to the anti-war movement, they tried a whisper campaign against Dr. King with illegal information. Imagine what they will do with legal information against anyone they would want. This is frightening. Big Brother is here and has license to do it, unquote. Yet the Times reported on July 22, 2002, regarding a 1983 FBI surveillance tape of Sharpton in an attempted cocaine deal that was aired on HBO last year. And this is, quote, the grainy tape was recorded as part of an FBI investigation into Mr. Sharpton's friend, a boxing promoter, Don King. The drug deal never went through and no charges were ever brought against Mr. Sharpton as a result of the operation. However, the FBI was said to have used the material to pressure Mr. Sharpton into becoming a government informant for 5 years on figures in organized crime and black leaders, as well as Mr. King. Sharpton himself admitted in a two-hour interview with Newsday that he wore body recorders in meetings with subjects under federal investigation, and that he also allowed a tap to be placed on his phone in his Brooklyn home. Sharpton's FBI activities for 5 years or perhaps longer, his dealings with the mob, his support for both the Democrats and Republicans while excluding the left, should be cause enough for concern about Sharpton's supposed anti-war, anti-racist credentials. So just think about that, y'all. I mean, the man speaks very intelligently. There ain't no doubt about that. But he got to come clean on that FBI stuff. We you know. Now, Carol Moseley Braun, we gonna leave that one alone because everybody
I don't think we talked about it last week. Tracy had pulled the tape up, you know, and she actually is not all that, you know, that left wing inspired. But I do want people to look out for the following. There's a film out now called Capturing the Freedmans. And this film is a must-see. This film is a must-see. It is a film about the arrest and frame-up of a computer teacher. A guy that was teaching people about computers, ostensibly for molesting children. But what you see, Tracy, what was the name? The McMartin Daycare Center? Was that called the McMartin? You know, Manhattan, I know they were on Manhattan Beach is where this daycare center was. I think it was called the McMartin Daycare Center, where they claimed that there was satanic rituals involved in mass rape of the children, all this madness. It was all garbage. But this documentary is similar. Well, it shows a similar case and lets you come to your own conclusion. It will be November 2nd. It's going to be in the Bay Area, the Victoria Red Theater, I think it's called. So let's keep our eyes open. I hope to give a fuller report. Also for the theater, Black Repertory Theater Group is showing a film called The Coffin Dealer and The Grave Digger, a play in three acts. It's actually, I think you might want to call the Black Repertory Theater, and that's 510-652-2120, and check their schedule. They may have a new play by now. So that's all right now for the Making Play News Service. Please.
Energy reports, and also from the U.S. Army Environmental Policy Institute report, it is also contaminated with plutonium, neptunium, and americium in many cases. The uranium munition that's fired by the A-10 Warthog aircraft is approximately 0.75 pounds for each individual round, and the A-10 can fire it at a rate of up to 4,000 rounds a minute. That's 1.5 tons of solid uranium fired into a target per minute. The uranium munitions are also contained in a lot of the bunker buster bombs and also submunitions, landmines such as the ATEM and the PETEM. We also have it in a 25-millimeter round that is fired by the Bradley fighting vehicle and also by the U.S. Marine Corps' lab. In addition to that, we have a 20-millimeter round that's fired by the Navy, and that's the Phalanx naval system. So what we're seeing is, because uranium munitions are absolutely effective in combat, they are an absolute killer and destroyer, the military has put them into almost every munition they can find and think of. It's extremely effective. It kills and destroys everything that it hits. Well, depleted uranium is kind of a confusing term. There's nothing really depleted about it. If you take, for every 100 pounds of solid uranium that you have, which is put into the enrichment process, you're able to retrieve 0.6 pounds of fissionable components. The other over 99.4 pounds is what we call uranium-238, and that's what they deem depleted uranium. So there's nothing really depleted about it other than the fissionable components been removed. Now, Di Williams, who's an independent researcher over in England, has done extensive research looking at the patent office applications, verified that uranium was contained in these bombs. And then the other thing, too, is when you watch them go off on TV, uranium munitions, if they are contained, they leave a very distinctive signature. You'll see it in a conventional explosion, the fire, the blast, and the concussion and everything going. In the uranium munition, you'll see sparklers and heavy metal uranium, which is pyrophoric, will continue to burn for an extensive period of time after all of the other detonation, the initial fireball and the explosion with the smoke and everything is over. Very distinctive. These uranium munitions, what happens is each individual round, once it leaves the barrel of the gun that fired it, catches fire because uranium is pyrophoric. So it's already on fire as the round races downrange to hit any target. It can be a building, it can be a lightweight vehicle, a car, a truck, it can be a tank, or it can be an armored personnel carrier. It's effective on everything. When I did the research in Nevada for the U.S. Army in 94 and 95, I actually shot up wood, and it worked just as great hitting a wood target as it did anything else. Now, when it impacts, you have a 10-pound rod of solid uranium, okay, that's fired by the Abrams tank. When that impacts, about 40% or about 4 pounds turns into what we call uranium spalling and oxides. That stuff is on fire, moving extremely high velocity across a confined space and causes secondary detonations, either due to concussion or due to ignition burning. And then what you have is a whole bunch of oxides forming all the contamination in and around the vehicle. My actual measurements go out to 400 meters in and around a single vehicle for a single incident. And what we found and what the Army has also agreed on is that within 25 to 50 meters, the contamination is so extensive that the U.S. soldiers must wear respiratory and skin protection to be in that region. So it's real simple. You end up with massive contamination. Now, the health effects that what we saw immediately were documented as early as I can verify in what's called the Groves Memorandum that was issued on October 30th of 1943. And in there it stated the respiratory problems and rashes and everything would start within hours and permanent damage within days. That's exactly what happened to myself and the others that were tasked to clean it up. I mean, not even a question. So with the overall health effects of uranium and heavy metals, you got a heavy metal radiological toxin that once it's ingested into the body, absorbed into the body, or shrapnel is deliberately left on the body as the military directed to be done for the friendly fire casualties, you end up with cancers, neurological problems, fibromyalgia, cataracts, respiratory problems, rashes, and the whole host of things associated with heavy metal toxicity and radiological exposures. One thing that we know for sure is during Gulf War I that we fired close to 1 million rounds, if not over 1 million rounds, from the A-10. So each individual round was 3/4 pound of solid uranium. So that's about 750,000 pounds. Okay, so that's an unbelievable amount of solid uranium left all over in the desert. Then we fired up probably close to 15,000 tank rounds, and we left them there. And much less any of the other large missiles, such that the cruise missile, which does have uranium in it, again, verified by the patent office and also verified by direct on-site measurements of impact holes. What we saw was all of us getting sick right away. We immediately directed medical care that should be provided. I did that as a theater health physicist. The theater medical commander sent a written order for medical care in June of 1991 for medical care for all DU exposures. What happened is even though we were getting sick and everything, medical care was denied, deliberately denied. The reports that we were put out there, again, were supposed to be covered up. The famous Los Alamos Memorandum that I received in March of 1991 was very clear. If we don't put out a case to use this stuff and cover up the health and environmental effects of uranium munitions, we will lose it. A Defense Nuclear Agency report that I received in March of 1991 was very clear. It said that uranium munitions and everything are not only a health threat, they are a serious health threat. And that's what every document that I've been able to find from the military completely states over and over. And then my own health effects, the team members of my own health effects, the friendly fire casualties that are sick, the individuals that have died where the autopsies have verified it, the individuals that work in the areas where they mine and produce uranium munitions are all sick. It's not even a question. The book Discounted Casualties, which was published a couple months ago, totally explains and clarifies and reveals the extent of the health effects all over the world. My exposure was due to inhalation, and that was faulty gas masks, which are faulty today, and the Department of the Army has acknowledged that, the Department of Defense has acknowledged it, the U.S. General Accounting Office has verified that the gas masks are defective. The filters are inadequate to take out the primary less than 0.1, 0.3 micron uranium particles that go right in the lung. And so therefore we had problems. When I got tasked by the Army to clean it up in 1991, we were all sick within 24 hours with respiratory problems and rashes, and they continued. The first cancers that our team developed within 8 to 9 months. The first death from cancers within couple of years. The United States Army Common Task Training Manual that all soldiers must comply with, and again, it's the depleted uranium task, requires full respiratory and skin protection in and around any uranium munitions used downwind or in a vehicle that's been hit. Absolutely fine. The other problems that you have is, yes, the rashes.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
Tried to avoid some of this issue as much as possible because it's such a specious subject matter being perpetrated, in my opinion, by the lesser of evil fraction. And but since there's the element, and it's getting stronger and stronger, that is on the campaign trail again. Once again, like we dealt with Dennis Kucinich and then this other guy who was yapping on KPFA about how Nader destroyed the world and all of that stuff. We're going to have to deal with another show I heard on KPFA. It dealt with Norm Solomon and Ruth Connick, who writes for The Nation magazine. They were on KPFA recently on the morning show with Andrea Pritchett, I think her name is, or something, and Philip Maldry. Well, first, Ruth Connick addresses the rising popularity of Dean. So let's see what she means by that, and then let's take it beyond the shadow. Check this out.
who are deemed unelectable and some who seem to be rising and getting a bit more attention, one of those being Howard Dean, obviously Dennis Kucinich, one of the favorites among many progressives, and also folks are wondering, what is Ralph Nader going to do? Is there going to be another Green Party candidate? And what might that do to the chances of G.W. Bush being reelected, which seems to be everyone's major concern? Joining us to talk about these questions and more, Norman Solomon, well-known author and author of the book Target Iraq. And what's that subtitle again, Norman?
It goes something like this, What the News Media Didn't Tell You.
Ah, exactly. Thanks, Norman, for being with us. Always a pleasure to have you.
Glad to be here.
And also joining us, Ruth Conniff, political editor for the Progressive Magazine, based in Madison, Wisconsin. Welcome, Ruth.
Thanks.
I know you also write a lot about these presidential candidates, so let's start with you. I know Norman has written about Howard Dean on the Common Dreams website. What are your thoughts? Let me just start with him and ask whether you think we should really be looking to him as the most electable and therefore the candidate we should be supporting.
Who are you going to, Andrea? Is it me or Norman?
You, Ruth.
Oh, okay. I thought you said...
I did. I was just bringing up that I know Norman wrote about this recently.
I get it.
This
Let's
question.
Start with Dean.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, I think the Dean phenomenon is really interesting, and I think it's fed by a lot of progressive energy. There are a lot of people who are quite progressive who are excited about Dean, and the main thing that Dean is doing is being the loudest and most visible candidate to attack Bush aggressively, which is just a tremendous catharsis for, you know, the great number of Americans who are appalled by this administration and really want someone to give voice to that. And it's particularly appealing in an era when the Democratic Leadership Council has gained so much control over the Democratic Party and has counseled so much caution. And I think when people are just outraged by how right-wing and how aggressive this administration is, both in foreign policy and domestically, it's maddening to see the Democrats pull their punches. So Dean is taking a more aggressive tack, and that is really appealing to people a lot. You know, I think it's also very clear that he is not the most progressive candidate in the field by a long shot. Dennis Kucinich is much more progressive, and that he is not really... His policies don't really embody necessarily the hopes and dreams of the progressive movement, certainly not for the people who supported Ralph Nader the last time around. But it's a different, you know, it's a different time, and people, I think, are really focused on beating Bush. I don't think they're naive about the fact that Dean is more of a centrist than a leftist. I think they're just really glad to see some kind of aggressive challenge.
They just want to see an aggressive challenge. I don't know. Yeah, well, you know what? Sound like she's one of them new age, you know, kind of thinkers or lack of thinking. It's true. There is a hunger out here to see somebody take on, you understand, this boy George. But as Tracy and I have been hammering away, and think about this, folks, what are they for? What is their program? If their program is for a strong military, then what you have is just a minor tactical squabble. That's not the major issue, you understand? Always look for the program. What are they actually advocating? And then what you're going to find is what's real, and not what don't let your mind play tricks on you because you want to see a strong challenge to Bush.
All right, first off, part of the reason why I don't take these cats serious when, and I'm not even talking about Dean and them. I'll deal with Dean first. I mean, we know that Dean has been involved in a number of things. What often happens is that since people are caught up in him screaming at Bush, it's like we're brought down to some very juvenile level. Anyone that's talking back to Bush or calling Bush what he is, you know, a moron or whatever, then somehow that means that this person has the masses of people's overall interest. Yet, time after time, Dean's solutions to many serious issues like, say, Social Security. What's his solution? Raise the age of people's retirement to 70. That's his solution.
That's right.
He used to be against the death penalty, but now he has to be more pragmatic because more and more people are looking towards him as a serious candidate. So he jumps, his pragmatism is basically now to support the death penalty. Now, this is a person who at one time opposed the death penalty because he simply said the innocent might die. But the more serious, quote-unquote, he's supposed to be taken within the bourgeois spectrum of things, the more he can't have these, quote-unquote, radical positions, human positions, basically. Dean, when he was speaking to the Jewish Weekly, and that's what you have to do sometimes, look in some of these little right-wing publications when they're being interviewed, stuff like that. See what they say there, because they don't always report it in the right-wing corporate mainstream papers. Well, in the foreword, Dean said this concerning the whole issue of the war on terrorism and things of that nature. The United States has to take a much harder line on Iran and Saudi Arabia because they're funding terrorism. Now, basically, that's right in alignment with the project of New American Century, because we all know that they're not really fighting terrorism. This is about global expansionism in that region of the world. Making sure that none of them go the euro dollar like Iraq did. That was one of the first things they did. They made the Iraqi oil that Saddam had started trading into, because he had gone euro, they flipped it right back over to the U.S. dollar.
Right.
So these types of issues often get ignored. His policies on the Mideast, when he was asked about his views about does he align with the more liberal Zionists, that being like America for Peace Now, APN, or the more totalitarian committees of the Zionist crew, like the American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, IAPAC, Dean said that in my view is closer to IPAC. So once again, he's aligning himself with even the more extreme version of some of the problem causes in that region in the first place. Now, one of the reasons why, as I've been saying, I don't take some of these guys serious on some of this stuff is that, you know, every 4 years you see them gathering around, they start whining about how the left, liberals, progressives, it's all one big lump. The nonviolent, you know, activists all should go for the lesser of two evils. Now, think about it. If someone was really serious, we have all of these pseudo-progressives and, quote, progressives out there, many authors on books on these subject matters that follow these the terrorist campaigns of the U.S. year-round. You see all these different shows and programs on what U.S. terrorism is doing around the world and its policies. If these guys, like the woman who was just talking, Conniff, were serious, they would actually put together a program that says what is the lowest amount of the lesser concept that they would accept. You know, so basically what I'm saying is, now this is a hypothetical, okay, if the candidate supports the State of Israel, then we can't support him. If they support the School of the Americas, we cannot support him.
There you go. Keep talking.
If they support WTO policies, then we can't support them. If they support policies and maneuvers like what happened in Venezuela under Chavez, the soft coup, then we can't support them. In other words, if these lesser of two evil candidates are our advocates, were really serious, they would lay out a program, argue it out, have their own little convention, you know, where all the different progressives get together, and then say, okay, this is our platform, and this is what we can accept, and this is what we can't accept, so that the masses of people would know, or at least have an idea of what their concept is of a lesser of two evils. But the reality is that they know that there's no level that a raggedy Democrat won't sink to. So they can't really create a lesser of two evils concept, because at the end of the day, a raggedy Democrat, like a raggedy Republican, will do anything to increase the empire's power. Mm-hmm. See, that's the issue right there. So they want to keep us trapped into this, you know, pseudo-psychological debate going back and forth about the lesser of two evils without creating a firm grip on the standards of criteria. If there is, quote-unquote, their seriousness about a lesser of two evils, one would have to say, and they had a program or serious about into believing that we should participate, or at least that progressives and like-minded progressives, because some of us, you know, they know not to even come with that stuff too, that a part of the socially conscious milieu should adapt their particular strategy without them laying out on the table a strategy to eventually have some kind of victory in the end. Now, next, Norm Solomon addresses some of the truer aspects of Dean and where progressives should stand, though. Check this out.
Well, Norman Solomon, in your article on Common Dreams from August 26, Dean Hopes and Green Dreams, a 2004 presidential race, you take up much of what Ruth was just talking about and try to kind of strip away this idea that Dean is somehow a progressive savior. So maybe you could comment on what Ruth said or summarize your article, whatever you prefer.
Well, I think supporters of Dean really run the gamut. Some recognize what he said recently, that he is a moderate in his soul, that he has said he was a triangulator before Bill Clinton, which is to say polarizes not only with Republicans, but with progressives and their constituencies as well, including, by the way, poor people. And so I think the key question for us is whether we're all going to try to go into this as best we can and encourage others to go into it with our eyes open. We need to remind ourselves, I think, that Howard Dean's name is not going to be on the same ballot as Bush's between now and next summer. And so the question in front of us now is the fight for the nomination. I definitely would urge that people vote for Howard Dean if he becomes the Democratic presidential nominee. But we're not there yet. And we get a lot of conjecture about who would have the best chance to defeat Bush in November next year, but that's really what it is. You know, the Gephardt supporters, the Kerry supporters, others will make that case. Dean backers do as well. But I think especially at this stage, it's important that we not permit the hype behind the Dean campaign and the news media to redefine what it means to be progressive using Dean as that tool. I mean, there is some conflict between the Democratic Leadership Council and Dean, for instance, around his proposals to totally roll back the Bush tax cuts. But I think, in essence, his economic outlook is not that different from the corporate-backed DLC. And if progressives find themselves more and more simply doing PR for Dean, I don't think it does the left any good, and incidentally, in the long run, I don't think it particularly does Dean any good. So to just kind of summarize, I think it's important that we all along the way be candid publicly as well as privately about who Dean is and what he represents.
All right. Now, Norm is fairly straightforward. Basically, at the end of the day, is still voting for the lesser of two evils in his whole concept. But he's trying to be strategic about don't put all your eggs in one basket. More or less, we can push these guys, hopefully, to a more progressive level if we vote openly about who you want before the actual runoff against Boy George, who's going to be the candidate on the Republicans. Now, one of the... you know, there's a sickness about all of this at the end of the day, because from a human internationalist perspective, it's the masses of the people who find themselves daily, yearly, and by the decades gripped within this whole construct of the failure of the left in America, and also the strategy of the lesser evil by the Democrats and Republicans, the business parties themselves, because in reality, the capitalists play this game. And in essence, what I'm saying is that the Democrats and Republicans have for years said to the American public and practiced it out that when it comes to a leader of a state that is a communist, they'll take a dictator. They'll take a nationalist over a dictator. They'll take someone who is preaching liberation theology. I mean, they'll take a dictator over a liberation theologist. They'll take a dictator over a nationalist. They'll take a dictator over a communist. They'll take anything over someone who's trying to pool their resources for the masses of their people within their own country. So this is how you've had issues like Chile happen on the original September 11th, 1973, where in the end, hundreds of thousands lost their lives because the ruling class plays their own version of a lesser of two evils game. See, so you have a situation where the Democrats and Republicans, they don't differentiate when it comes to their particular ideology of a lesser of two evils. If you don't conform to their market capital imperial system, they'll do anything to remove you from office. Aristide, 67% of the vote in Haiti by the masses. The U.S.-backed candidate, 13%. The U.S. didn't like that because Aristide was running under a liberation theology that was going to put in minimum wage, a form of social security, child labor laws, environmental clauses. So the U.S. ends up creating and backing, in their lesser of two evil concept, a terrorism squad, FRAP. So they preferred having a terrorist squad called FRAP over Aristide. That was their lesser of two evils.
That's it.
And the end result was thousands of people's lives. See, these little raggedy progressives over here in La-La Land are being extremely self-indulgent and detached from the world community and how their concessions to the ruling class has played havoc on the lives of the masses of our sisters and brothers throughout the world. Them up here playing footsies with the Democrats and coming up with this lesser of two evils stuff, where in every step of the way, they have shown that they'll strategically work together, even as a coalition, to stop a quote-unquote lesser of two evils. Another case in point. Under the whole Democrat-Republican bourgeois political rules when running for presidency, if you were projected to have at least 5% of the vote, you would be allowed to get into the debates. Nader had 5%. So the Democrats and Republicans got together and said, look, we got to strategize on a lesser of two evils. And the lesser of two evils is we work together as opposed to having Nader get involved in the debate. So even on a basic level of just letting Nader in on a debate, they strategized in their lesser of two evil concept and once again raised the level to 15%. You don't hear a peep about this from the so-called lesser of two evils, less vote Democrat now candidates. So in essence, what I'm saying is that when they don't call these entities on it and allow this stuff to go on, this helps perpetuate the stagnation of the development of alternative movements within the society.
Yeah. Now, for Mr. Solomon, though, I actually respect some of the work he does with the magazine called Extra. You know, they show some media inconsistencies and fallibilities that are quite useful. So we're not going to... You know, we ain't downing him as a human being on every front. But let's, his own words. What did he say? He said, whoever gets chosen. He actually said it. It's not Tracy making it up and trying to make him look bad. That's what he said. And why did he say it? Because he meant it. Then what did we say? I thought that was an excellent way of saying the same point that I made on the first round program. May I see your political passport? Who are you? No, I don't mean what color polka dot you got on your drawers. Who are you as a political person? What is your intention? What is your record? Look, these people so sad and sorry that they be changing their line before the election ever happened. You got Arnold Schwarzenegger running around talking about, yo, I ain't taking no money from no special interests. I'm against the unions. I'm against special. First thing you do is take money from corporations. He just started. Now, you got this guy Dean changing up here and there. And the thing just started. They're not even in the dead heat yet. And he's lying. Now, look, Malcolm X said something very plain and very clear, and I'm going to bring it back. In fact, this is going to become one of my little slogans during this whole election campaign. When Malcolm X was talking about the fact that a Dixiecrat is nothing but a Democrat, he went on, and I forget exactly which speech, I'll try to track it down, but he said, brothers and sisters, you can't turn, can't make a chicken lay a duck egg. And he was talking about the system, you see? And I would like to take that analogy and put it on the Democratic Party. You cannot make a Democrat produce a candidate that's going to fight in the interests of the oppressed, because that's not what it's a machinery for. The Democratic Party is a machinery to collect votes for a ruling class party, an imperialist ruling class party. That's what it is. Fantasies by these fake leftists notwithstanding. The other thing, Trace, what he say, that when you say that these people detach from the world community, it ain't just the world community, they detach from the community right here. Part of the reason...
Oh, we know that.
That's right. Part of the reason that we feel the way we do here at Slavery Fold is because we see in our lives every day what is happening to the black people, to the working class. And we're against it for real. That's why we try to arouse you, educate you, incite you to struggle against these conditions. Thank you.
Next, Ruth Conant addresses the Nader-Gore phenomenon and the split by those who vote, in that process and the tactical discrepancies. So let's check out what she has to say and take it from there. Check this out.
Kind of, Norman brought up an interesting point, and it reminds me of an email I got about something someone heard both on the show and some writing that I had done for the Progressive Media Project, and the person really took issue with even using that term progressive and seemed to be saying people who identify as progressive think that they are better than traditional Democrats, and it sort of pointed out to me more of a kind of rift, I guess, in the left than I had been that aware of. So do you think that that letter is representative of a lot of people's feelings that, you know, progressives in some way are messing up our chances, for instance, in this election, if they get too progressive and don't, like, go with the best candidate to beat Bush?
Well, I think that's definitely... I think people have a very chastened feeling. A lot of Democrats have a very chastened feeling after the last election because, I mean, personally, I struggle with this. You know, I was enthusiastic about Ralph Nader. You know, the Progressive Magazine is a nonprofit, and we don't back candidates. I covered him a lot, and it was very exciting to hear somebody who was so right on. And the contrast between him and Al Gore was tremendous. I mean, Al Gore came to town here in Madison, Wisconsin, and, you know, talked about how great welfare reform was and, you know, that people need to have their guns. And he was, you know, very uninspiring. And Nader came and really took him apart. The thing that was also really offensive about the last election was that a lot of Democratic members of Congress and others, people like Barney Frank, who call themselves progressives and have fairly progressive voting records, came through to yell at left-wing types for supporting Nader, to say, you've got to get in line, you've got to support Al Gore, he's the best you're going to do, and really took a very negative tone. And this is the same thing you see the DLC doing now when they talk about how terrible it is that the party base is excited by Dean. They say, you know, we've got to shut these people up. You know, if you don't back the war in Iraq and you don't back a lot of Bush's tax cuts, you can't win. And so all the excitement and all the energy in the party is what they want to tamp down because they think they'll win the election with a really mealy-mouthed candidate. And it didn't work with Al Gore, and it's, I think, certainly not going to work this time. So anyway, people, I think, have reason to be mad at the Democratic Party leaders on the progressive side. And I think the people in the Democratic Party who hate Bush and think, well, there you go, you know, in a close election, what difference did Nader ultimately make? And isn't Bush a lot worse than advertised? I think they have a point, too. And I think, so there's a lot of caution. I think a lot of people would like to win this time. They would like to oust Bush, and they would like to, you know, just fix some of the really hideous problems that are blossoming under Bush in our country. So it's I think it's a very different election than last time. I think I personally feel that I didn't appreciate how bad the Bush administration would be. And I think, you know, it's important to be honest about that. And I think you have to ask yourself, what kind of a country are we living in, and what are the possibilities for doing something? You know, Nader talked a lot about building a third-party movement and having this tremendous social change in this country. It was very inspiring. Mm-hmm. But I don't see Nader himself investing a lot of energy in building the Green Party. Actually, he's never joined it. And I don't see, you know, at this juncture with Bush in the White House and a tough election coming up, I mean, God bless the people who are really going to pour their energy into third-party politics or, you know, more idealistic endeavors, but I think it does tend to make you into more of a short-term thinker when you see how dire things are.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I would add that I think for different reasons in 2000, both Ralph Nader and Karl Rove had incentives to play down the extremism of George W. Bush and his entire team. Now we've got more data. We know what has happened in the Bush administration we're living under now. And I think it's fair to say that the Bush team has really gotten close to some elements of fascism in its day-to-day operation. So do we want to find out how fascistic they can get during a second term of George W. Bush's presidency? I don't think so. At the same time, certainly the Green Party has a right to exist and try to flourish. We should respect that. I certainly am enthusiastic about a lot of local races that Green candidates have chosen to run, and I think we ought to nurture that. But at the same time, there's a fixation at the National Green Party level with running Ralph again. I think it's destructive politically for the country at large, and I say that as somebody who was publicly supportive of Nader's campaign in 96 and 2000. But, I mean, let's deal with the objective conditions and not simply project our subjective desires into this historical period that we are right now in. Let's not blur the realities.
Basically, what you're kind of hearing is people who have been demoralized, they don't really think that we can win. Because when you have someone say that that the DLC is basically using coercion, telling people to get in line, don't vote for Nader or other alternative quote-unquote candidates, and there's no issue about them having to have to earn your vote. You know, the whole concept of someone earning your vote, you know, that you actually say something and have a program that they agree with and thereby earn their respect and vote, that's just out the issue. And the fact that you have progressives, quote unquote, actually going along with this and then summing it up as Ruth Connors said, because so many people this time would, quote unquote, like to win. Well, what does that mean? What are we actually winning if you have to basically give up everything that you principally stand for? You are basically neutering yourself to so-called get ahead. These contradictions. And then to try to say that people who have alternative ideas or into alternative parties are short-term thinkers is like the height of hypocrisy, because these cats come around every 4 years, a year before the presidential election, and they get on this support the Democrats campaign. They're not trying to project any kind of long-term strategy for the working class because they don't believe in it. You know, and that's okay, but don't just fake it and stuff. You had a president, crime Bill Clinton, who, when he got, before he got into office, he promised the Haitian refugees asylum. He tipped the boat over. Then he surrendered, just gave it up to the Pentagon under the whole, in the military, and came through with that whole don't ask, don't tell.
Right, with the gays, right?
Right. He bowed down under pressure to drug companies and withdrew his plan and program for free immunization for kids. So even that basic one, he didn't do anything when Congress defeated legislation banning or allowing the use of scabs and strikes. So time after time, you know, it was crime Bill Clinton and his being tough on crime persona that pushed through more expanding federal death penalties, the whole Crime Bill II Anti-Terrorism Act. That was all under crime bill. See, he helped set the stage of what we're into now.
Yes, he did.
The whole Telecommunications Act. See, when you have people talking about the recent victory we've had over Michael Powell, the whole FCC thing where they tried to expand the grips of control of corporations in owning more and more stations. The platform that Michael Powell and these other thugs have been able to catapult off of to go into the next level was Crime Bill's 1996 Telecommunications Act. So these types of things just kind of dissipate in the minds of many of these so-called progressives every time the four-year cycle comes up. Now, what's fascinating about this is that a former Clinton labor secretary, Robert Reich, he wrote an article, and he was describing overall about basically at the end of the day what happens with the Democratic Party and the promise of Gore and crime bill, the promise that they hold up to, at least for the ruling class. He says, quote, "No administration in modern history has been as good for American business as the Clinton-Gore team. None has been as solicitous of the concerns of business leaders. None has generated as much profit for business, and none has presided over as buoyant a stock market or as huge an increase in executive pay. And no vice president in modern history has had as much influence in setting an administration's agenda as Mr. Gore. Business should bear in mind a long and distinguished pattern to American politics. Once in office, Democratic presidents tend to shift to the right without risk of losing their Democratic base because it has no one else to turn to."
Mm-hmm.
Unquote. So here's a strategist just laying it out. What happens when you walk to the crossroads, give your soul over to scratch to enter into the Democratic process of hell, the Democratic Party, the house of hell, that you have nowhere else to go once you do that. So for so-called progressives to actually advocate this,
mm-hmm,
instead of trying to get people to break away from that tradition for their own survival shows right there what this is all about.
That's why I'm going to tell the truth about Miss Lady Ruth. You know something, Tracy? You just laid it out. But truth of the, there's another voter that these people, because they have no roots, really, they're rootless intellectuals, and that is the people that don't vote at all because they don't believe in none of this. And I'm not saying that those people agree with my program. I'm not claiming that. But I am claiming this, that those people have been disappointed and betrayed enough, have seen through the lies and the bullshit, to the point they're not even going to walk to the corner and encourage you. It's gone down to something like, what, 30, 25% of the American public voting in national elections now? That's a minority of voters. Now, the bourgeoisie thinks that that's okay, just long as we give our cheese, long as we continue to do our thing. But truth of the matter is, that's quite dangerous. That level of alienation, boy, I tell you, when the working class does begin to fight back, it's going to get crazy around here. And they're going to want to look back and see who was it that was running interference for these so-called Democrats and lying to us and getting us the trade union bureaucracy and these fake leftists on KPFA. So as an alternative to that, we here at Slave Revolt say, no, no. These people are not your friends, and they're advocates. Well, shameless. You know what? They just did a movie, Tracy. Chris Rock. What's the name of that movie? Executive something? Or I forget the name of the movie. It's a video right now. Go get that video, folks. Because Chris Rock, I know, you know, people may think he's not political or whatever, but what he does is objectively a criticism of the Democratic Party. The theme of the movie is that the Democrats didn't think they could win this election, so they picked this black alderman, Chris Rock, to run, feeling like he ain't got a chance of winning no way. Eventually, Chris Rock jettisons the Democratic Party's triangulation methods and the jive speeches that they prepare for him, and he starts talking to people about what's going on in their lives. And he becomes enormously popular. I can't say no more about the movie, but it does, because I don't want to ruin it for you, but it does give you an insight into the sick mentality of these Democratic Party strategists. Two unemployed strategists we just heard, and that's Solomon and Ms. Roof, who's scared of the truth.
All right, Andrea asked Norm Solomon about the strategy of backing Dennis Kucinich at this stage with in the whole or before the whole primary. Check this out.
Solomon, one of the things that Ruth Conniff mentioned, I think, is happening with Dennis Kucinich, which is this, it's so refreshing to hear someone actually talking about progressive values and not be afraid to do it in the, you know, whole sort of post-9/11 climate we've been dealing with, that people are just loving just hearing that and wanting to really support that and support his campaign. And one of the things that you mentioned again in your Common Dreams piece is that at this stage, maybe it is a good idea to support him because that will push the Democratic Party to perhaps a more progressive platform. So is that your thinking at this point?
I think it would be good for Kucinich to go into the convention with a large block of delegates, if possible. I'm afraid people sometimes get confused between the question of voting in November 2004 and voting in the upcoming primaries. If you vote for Kucinich, you're not helping Bush get reelected. You're simply conveying support for a very progressive platform, which is quite in contrast to most of what Dean stands for. Here's a guy, Howard Dean, who says that he's against cutting the military budget, who says he supports an occupation of Iraq. He says it should and could go on for years with U.S. troops there. The guy doesn't challenge fundamental assumptions about U.S. foreign policy that, frankly, are to a large degree shared by the so-called leaderships of both parties. So I think for people to shy away from supporting Kucinich at this stage is a big mistake.
Ruth Conniff, what are your thoughts about Dennis Kucinich at this point? I think some people might think, well, one thing it might do if you support him now is take money and sort of momentum away from someone like Howard Dean and maybe allow someone like Joe Lieberman or someone to sneak in there. So what are your thoughts on Kucinich in general at this point in the campaign?
Well, I think Lieberman is the great example of how far progressives just can't go. I mean, Lieberman's a nominee. It would still be very hard for me to pull that lever. I just don't. But Lieberman's not going to be the nominee. I mean, I really don't think that that's actually going to happen. I think, you know, Dean and Kerry are sort of duking it out at the moment, and a lot could happen. Kucinich is a wonderful guy. I know him personally. I remember when he first went to Washington in 97. He has an almost otherworldly, poetic kind of presence. He is, you know, I think an interesting, deeply principled, non,
you know, almost just antithetical to a politician. You know, he's sort of a seamless garment Catholic. I know he's sort of changed his position on abortion a bit and now says that he's pro-choice, but, you know, I think he was pro-life in the same for the same reasons that he's a vegan. And these are the kinds of things that he comes out in public and talks about, which really puts him way out of the mainstream. But he has a very charming, very... you know, he's deeply philosophical, and he's really, truly the peace candidate. He's opposed all of the military interventions that have come down the pike, except for Afghanistan, while he's been in office in Washington. I guess this is what I think, and I don't know that this is as sophisticated as Norm Solomon's analysis. I just don't have a lot of energy. At this point, having been through the last election, it feels so recently, mm-hmm. for a candidate who is a wonderful person, who seems way, way out of the mainstream, and who says a lot of things that I agree with and like, but that don't seem to have a whole lot to do with moving politics forward. And I mean, I think candidates like that, I suppose their appeal rises and falls depending on the mood of the electorate. And so to me, it's not an issue of telling people that they shouldn't support Kucinich. My feeling, I mean, I'm just being very honest, mm-hmm. my feeling about this is that it's hard for me to get energized for it, because what I see is John Ashcroft, you know, bringing about what Norm Solomon, I think, rightly calls a fascist program in our country, and we see this incredible erosion of civil liberties. I see a few people in Washington who are willing to stand up in an effective way against it, like Russ Feingold, the senator from Wisconsin, criticizing. I see, you know, just this incredible corporate power, the growth of corporate power over environmental policy in Washington, Iraq. I mean, there's just one thing after another, right? And so it's hard, you know, it's hard to get excited about a candidacy that doesn't seem to be contributing to taking that down. Now, I agree with Norm that maybe the important thing is for there to be as many voices as possible for true labor reform, which is what, you know, Kucinich is definitely way out ahead on labor issues and has gotten a lot of excitement among unions for that reason. I think it's important that those voices exist and that the party still contain some semblance of its, you know, its basic principles. So for that reason, yeah, I think it's great that somebody like Kucinich is out there making those points, but I'm not making the point that Barney Frank made in the last election, you mustn't put your energy into this because it'll be destructive somehow. It's more a question of sort of where is your focus when you feel like things are so dire.
All right, once again, we have a situation where, you know, nothing is really defined. That's why I brought up this whole thing about, for those of her who advocate this lesser of two evil concept, it behooves them. It should be, if they were serious, it would be their obligation to set up some kind of thing where they could work out what is their concept of the lesser of two evil, what they will tolerate, and what is the bottom of what they will tolerate and what's beyond the scale. Without defining that and being able to take it to the masses of who they say they represent and are a part of, then there's no seriousness to this whole process.
That's right.
And that's because at the end of the day, one is basically psychologically defeated. To talk about Kucinich being a vegan, well, Adolf Hitler was a vegetarian.
Vegan.
So, I mean, you know, he loved his little dog and all of that stuff. So, I mean, so it doesn't mean anything of any real substance. And this helps perpetuate the masses of people being isolated and disgruntled and disenfranchised with this whole thing. So you have a situation where one could talk about Kucinich not supporting the war, but if Kucinich supported the sanctions, then basically he accepted the imperialist deconstruction through a war mechanism of the Iraqi people. More Iraqi people perished under the whole sanctions than died during the process of this immediate war. Now, who knows where it's going to all end up? But selfishly and narrowly define quote-unquote acts of war And then hide under the banner of the UN policies and all of that. I mean, it's just it's past sickness. Now, the whole stuff about her saying that she's also wary of candidates who, in essence, can't make the politics move forward. In essence, what she's talking about is that the way the corporate media structure is set up to determine who is serious and who is not. Well, see, this is why if you rely on the corporate media to define you, and the corporate media is owned by the ruling class, then we'll forever be slaves. You know, if you truly believe in the masses you're trying to reach, then you have to go to the masses with alternative types of solutions and networking. This is just a historical fact and reality, whether we're talking about South Africa and the trade union papers independent, whether we're talking about Frederick Douglass and the North Star to reach his constituents independent, or whether we're talking about what we're trying to do here. The reality is if you truly take yourself serious and you truly see a class differentiation between where you sit and the masses sit and the ruling class at top, then you have to set up a different way of approaching and a different vehicle to approach those masses. You can't use the master's house and think he's going to allow you to reach the masses of people to overturn his plantation by training and organizing amongst the slaves in his house. You got to go to the plantation where the masses are and say it's time to revolt against master and burn the house down, you know. But sitting up in master's house and negotiating with other plantation masters, you know, in this house and talking about how we're going to make it better for the rest of us slaves out on the plantation, and you're just negotiating in the house. I mean, it's just sick. You know, the masses, the core of mass movements in this country have been done outside of the parameter of relying on the ruling class sector or the Republican or Democrats. The strategies of Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass, the Civil War, and how that played itself out. You didn't have black folks or the masses of hardcore abolitionists relying on those parties. The Civil Rights Movement within itself did not rely on one or another party for its own emancipation. So to think that you somehow are going to liberate yourself within the house of the master is somewhat revealing.
It's not just revealing. You know what it is? This is a fantasy. It is sick. You know what? Here's what I thought. While I watched Ruth run away from the truth, it just came to me, man, Tracy. I can see her now sitting here sometimes. Well, I'm not really a leftist anymore, but I used to be, and that's why they got me here at KPFA talking shit. Because they know, I know a little bit about the jargon, but at bottom, I'm a social conservative, and I ain't gonna rock the boat too much. Because that's what she basically just said.
Like I said before, they basically are demoralized.
Obviously.
So they're thrown in the...
Even Norman Solomon, it's kind of tragic with him because he's a very intelligent man.
Right.
But you have to call it like you see it. So now they're gonna tell us that Ashcroft... You know, you have to ask yourself, when you're listening to these so-called political commentators, what's your program? That is... What the hell has this got to do with shooting the landlord? Because that's what we want to know. When we going to get down to business here? See? And when they're just going off all into the moon and everything, and they telling us how we going to organize ourselves to fight back, they ain't saying nothing. Ashcroft is no fascist. Although he may have been. He may have been a member of the Ku Klux Klan at some point. I can see that's possible. But really, the changes that he is making with Bush... This is not fascism. This is the right wing of bourgeois politics. This is capitalist America. They don't need no fascists. Fascism is the last instrument of the ruling class to maintain power when the working class challenges that power. We ain't challenging nothing. This ain't no fascism. But why would they use something like that? Why would they even use the term? Yes, it's fascistic, it's fascist. Because they're trying to get you to stop thinking. What is fascism? When does it occur in capitalist society? How do we stop it? No, they want you to just stop thinking, panic. Ooh, here comes fascism. So they can stampede you back into that old raggedy-ass Democratic Party. That's right. It's not fascism at all. It's regular bourgeois politics. And you know something? We can do something about it. They are, despite all this old George Bush, that motherfucker's in, he's in trouble. He is in serious trouble. He can't finance his war, so he's going to go to the UN and say, he don't go to, he sent old Tom to the UN. Colin, get up. Go on over there and talk that shit you was talking a few months ago. Because I'm getting short on the cash. You'll have Colin Powell go and try to convince, so-called, the United Nations that really we love y'all anyway and we really want y'all to spend your money. You understand? But under our leadership, of course. And we get the money, of course. You know we can get all the oil and the money. But we just want y'all to feel good. And so y'all, what the hell are you talking about? Is that the sorriest, stupidest shit you ever... Who in their right mind is going to help the U.S. finance its empire? I mean, look at it. I mean, that's what it is. That's what they're asking the Europeans to do. It's just silly. But whatever we're going to be, brothers and sisters, let's not be silly. When these so-called pundits start running their mouth, just grab them by the collar and say, look here, where is your political passport? What do you stand for? What groups are you in? What are you doing to change this stinking-ass planet? And then you'll see the answer is nothing.
And also, you have a situation where you tie yourself into a situation where you're impotent. Because you have, like at this moment, a key opportunity to intersect into a lot of disgruntled G.I. Joes. There are a number of them sick. We've been doing shows on them where they medically discharged over 50 of them who had gotten some kind of ammonia, which was probably related to depleted uranium, because you get ammonia-like symptoms. You've already had some of the first homeless people from the Iraq war. So here you have a situation where you have a large segment of disenfranchised and disgruntled G.I. Joes. So if they were serious, they would try to intersect with them. But see, you can't intersect and try to build some kind of alternative to the imperialist structure if you're still tied within the Democratic Party. Because the Democratic Party is not going to come out and advocate for the true human rights of the G.I. Joes that are getting sick and have gotten sick. You have to have some kind of alternative program and initiative to kind of intersect and say, look, this G.I. Joe cowboy stuff, look where it's got you. Look what it's done to you. It's led you onto a road of destruction and disaster. Now, both parties help get you into this stuff. Now, don't you think it's time to turn to an alternative idea? You got two little bottled waters a day in 120-degree heat. Boy George is trying to take back your allowances more. It's time for you to revolt like the Vietnam soldiers did, because both parties are thrusting you into one hell after another. But if your strategy is to organize within the Democratic framework, Democratic Party framework, and that's what you're basically doing. When you say vote Democrat, you have to corral the masses of people you come in contact with into the Democratic Party framework, and thus use the same strategy as both bourgeois parties do, and leaving the disenfranchised, the unwashed masses untouched. That's political. That's a political decision making. To leave those who are disenfranchised and feel unempowered, to leave them where they are, this immiserated. Don't come with any kind of alternative. Don't try to reach out and touch them. Don't try to do anything where they can help uplift themselves. Just leave them confused, demoralized, and angry. That's a strategy that both the Democrats and Republicans play. And if you advocate what you see Ruth and Norm in this little KPFA milieu advocate, well, that at the end of the day is where you're going to be led to some more death and destruction, Democrat and Republican.
400 more years of this bullshit.
Well, the earth ain't got 400 more years at this rate. Hold on a sec. That's just going to about to wrap it up for Slave tonight, as we're being thrust into a constant stage of decadent war, destruction, and death, as long as we follow down the path or be led down a path of the imperialist milieu that some so-called progressives want us to. But as long as we keep our ideas and class consciousness intact, in our belief and historical knowledge of what we can do at the right and opportune times, when the war plays itself out, the real war, the real class war, the capitalists and their minions at KPFA have had it. Until the next time, Slave Revolt. Out.